It's getting to be silly season again, and one of the silliest things you could possibly think of just happened this last week. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry, it's great to be back with you again this week, as it is every week. And look, 2 weeks in a row, and we've got a new show. So we almost didn't have a new show last week, did we?
Well, it was difficult, yes.
Yeah, to say that there were problems. Those of you who listened to the program, our apologies. We sat around and thought about it for a while, and we realized what was going on that was causing such terrible trouble. Both of us had strong signals on our internet. And we were then Skype should have been fine. We can't figure out what the problem is. Well, I started noticing suddenly while we were in the middle of making the broadcast that my electricity was snapping. In other words, I was getting all these power surges on my, and my lights were flickering. And my computer, I didn't realize that the uninterruptible power supply had a dead battery in it. So every time a surge would come, it would shut my computer off. Not this computer, not the one we record on, but my main computer for my business. And it kept snapping off. I'm like, what is going on? Well, you and I discussed it. My gosh, there was a solar storm. One of the largest solar storms in decades was going on. And we were feeling the effects and hearing the effects of a solar storm on communications, and also seeing it, what happens to electricity during a massive solar storm. And let's just say that we were blessed by God with the fact that, and I mean not just you and me, but everyone here, that we didn't get a more direct hit from that thing. Because a direct hit from that thing, just from the power surges we were getting across the electric line and the communications disruptions through Skype, would have completely shut down things here in the United States of America. And my partners and I in this business have talked on numerous occasions that if something happened to our computer system and our access to the internet, which was also affected, by the way, by that solar storm, and you may have noticed that would have been the first week in September, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you would have, what would have happened had it all gone down? We're out of business. I can't make an invoice. I can't take an order because let's face it, folks, most of us are on cell phone these days. And cell phone communications were also not very good, as the Skype showed, because both Barry and I hooked to the internet. Well, I hooked to the internet through cable. Barry's hooked up through cell data. And all those things were affected by that. So what would happen? Well, the United States of America would be in very, very, very bad shape. How do you pump gasoline or diesel fuel out of the ground if there's no electricity? Sure, you can start up a generator, but if that solar storm continues, you'll burn that equipment up too. You need to, you know, we need to think about having backup systems that don't require technology. I mean, when we first started this business about 20 years ago, you know, we could get away with writing an invoice on paper. We could get away with, you know, because as long as the phones worked, and phones are old technology, you figure out how old a phone technology is. It's 140 years old. It's really old. You know, some of it's modernized and some of it's electronicized, but as long as you can get the phones to work, you can take an order and you can go down to the post office and ship it. You know, you can handwrite a label if you need to. Nowadays, we are so dependent on our electronic communications, that we're sunk. You and I depend on it because you don't have to drive 120 miles to come up here and record, and or I don't have to drive down to Chillicothe so we can come meet halfway and record.
Right.
So, Yeah, it works out really well for us, except when it doesn't work. And last week it didn't work very well. You know.
No, you're absolutely right. And again, there's a lot of things that we take for granted, I think, in our society today. And that, you know, sometimes we get a little glimpse of what it might be like when those things aren't there anymore. You know, we have become, as a society, Chuck, totally dependent upon technology. You know, living where I live, we are very close to a large population of Amish and Mennonites who, for some reason, our little pocket down here in Gallia County seems to be like the second favorite place in Ohio for, you know, folks who hold to the Amish and Mennonite ways of life to locate. And so oftentimes, as I'm driving around, you get to see or get to follow people in horse-drawn buggies. You get to see people whose houses don't have wires running into them because they don't have electricity in their houses. Or, you know, you see hand pumps outside because that's how they draw their waters from a well and not from a pipe that runs with pressure from the county water office. You see all these various different things, and sometimes, you can say, wow, you know, I can't understand how they could live like that. And then you stop and think to yourself, it wasn't all that long ago that we lived in a similar fashion in relation to technology specifically. Now,
within the memory of living people,
Running water and electricity in our homes.
Yeah.
But many of us still remember having to walk outside in whatever weather it was to go to that little building out back that had the half moon carved in the door.
Within the living memory,
because a lot of people didn't have indoor plumbing.
Within the memory of living people.
Absolutely. I mean, I can go to my aunt and uncle's house, which is, just a few miles down the road from here, and I can walk and I can still look at the old building that was their outhouse. And again, it wasn't until maybe the late 70s, early 80s that they had indoor plumbing in their old house, because back in those days, they just didn't put indoor plumbing in. I know in my home, it was built in the 1920s, and yes, there were bathrooms in it, but as we're digging through and doing some remodeling, you kind of realize that maybe one of these bathrooms wasn't here to start with and was put in after the fact.
Yeah, it's a retrofit.
So you have those things, but then it takes something like sunspot activity or coronal mass ejection is what they're calling it, and there was a big one, 9.2 in the X class is what they said, which is probably one of the biggest flares that they've measured at least in the last two decades. And, you know, many scientists and astronomers were like, well, thankfully it wasn't pointed directly at the Earth when it went off, or else we would have been back in the dark ages.
Yes, the whole...
Because
not
if
just...
you think about everything we do, Chuck, is tied to technology now. Our electric grid is computerized. Yep. Our water is pumped by machines that are hooked into computers and monitors. The things, when you go to the grocery store, all your food is cooled, you know, by electrical means. If we had a catastrophic event like a coronal mass ejection or solar flare of that magnitude that was pointed directly in line with the Earth, we would be living in the dark ages for a while. You know, the hurricane that just went through Florida, they're talking about days, possibly weeks, of people not having electricity because of the storm knocking power out. Can you imagine a solar storm that knocks out everything? Not just your electricity and your lights, but all your communication devices, your computers, your cars. Because remember, they all have computer chips in them now, too, that run the cars. What would life be like, Chuck, if we would have such an event happen in our lifetime?
It would be an extremely frightening event. You'd have to start thinking about what you were going to eat. Because,
yes,
let's face it, once your canned goods are gone and there's none available in the stores, because the product can't be cooked, it can't be canned, the cans can't be made, that kind of thing, you have to start thinking about how you're going to forage for yourself in whatever property surrounds your house. Now, I'd probably be all right because we'd just kill a couple deer. And we'd have meat.
Right.
And we could probably gather enough edible plants to get our greens and that kind of thing. But remember what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to build a fire pit and cook outside. because none of us anymore are equipped with a stove that burns wood or coal that we can cook on anymore.
Most don't. Some people still have that. I know we don't, but you're right. You're going to have to figure out how you're going to forage, how you're going to cook. And you mentioned the thing about canned goods running out of the store. Well, Chuck, as I mentioned, depending on how far you live from a store, if an EMP-type solar flare takes out all your computers, including the ones in your car, you better figure out if you got a bicycle to pedal to get back and forth to places, because, or a horse to ride on. Maybe the Amish are onto something here with the horses and buggies. and I'm not saying, become like a primitive again. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just suggesting that maybe we're taking a little bit too much for granted.
Well, we assume that God's going to continue his gracious protection of us from things like X-class solar flares. we've had them hit the country at the beginning of the technology era. For instance, one of these things was a direct hit in the mid-1900s century. And I can tell you that telegraph offices burst into flames from the power that was coming down the telegraph lines. So, is that the kind of thing that can happen? Yes, it is. And the fact is, Barry, what would you do if you pedaled into town on your bike and you got to the store? How would they exchange? I mean, unless you had cash. How are you going to exchange money?
Cash, or something that they were looking for in barter. You can't take your plastic.
As the generations proceed, the dependence upon technology is more and more and more and more. And by that I say, if you walked into Kroger's and you happened to find an employee who actually showed up for work out of a sense of duty or something, what would that employee be able to do for you? They are so completely I'll be quite honest, the younger generation is so completely clueless. Do you think even if you could come up with the cash that a cash register, somebody who had a cash box could make change for you?
Well, in some instances the answer to that is definitely no.
No.
And I'm sure that some of our listeners have experienced the frustration of standing in a line somewhere. And again, I don't want to necessarily, paint with too broad of a brush, because sometimes it's just somebody's on their first day and they're extremely nervous doing a good job, and they just their brains are so full of everything they're trying to remember about their training for work that they forget how to do simple tasks like, simple math in your head in order to make change.
Well,
but then there are some people who just don't who are not equipped. And I mean equipped by their educational background, by the schools that they went to, by whatever means, they're not equipped to handle those kind of things. And yes, I mean, without the computer, without the punching a button and it automatically telling you how much change to give, there'd be some people who'd be totally lost.
Oh, well, I'll be quite honest. One of the first things my dad taught me how to do when I was a kid was make change.
Oh yeah,
I know how to count change.
You try to teach kids to count that way.
Yeah, I learned how to count change back even when somebody gave you change. Let's say they gave you coins and the coins didn't add up to the amount on the cash register. He taught me to count back to odd amounts of coin being given out. So the fact is that most kids don't learn that. Now, perhaps mine was a little unique, but nonetheless, in the old days, you had to learn how to count back change. Now, what is the machine gives you the amount of change to give back, and I've had the thing miscalculate. I'll look at it and I go, that's not right. Sorry, I can do math. That is not correct. And they have to call a supervisor because they can't do the math. This has happened more than once.
And that's tragic, but yes. It does happen. But again, Chuck, it's one of those things of how much are we taking for granted?
Yes, how much?
Now we talk about this because we've had that little event happen and gave us a extremely minor taste of how things would completely change for us in our everyday lives and what we believe and how we go about living our lives just from the loss of our technology. Now, Chuck, I want to segue that because what we're talking about today, the big thing we're talking about today, what happens in our country with our freedoms that we hold dear and our rights and our liberties when our governing document is taken away from us? Yes, folks, that's right. We're back at it again. It's silly season. The legislature is back in session in Columbus. And sure enough, we got a notice last week, late last week, that our old stalking horse, the call for a constitutional convention or a convention of states call, was going to be coming back up in the Ohio Senate Government Oversight and Reform Committee for a hearing. Now, it wasn't marked for a vote, which I think was actually probably pretty smart of them, because I don't think that, well, we'll talk about that later. But it wasn't marked for a vote, but it was marked in for a hearing for basically anybody who wanted to come testify. It was for people who supported the ConCon, people like us who opposed the ConCon, and people who were just maybe sitting on the sidelines wondering what this ConCon thing's all about. So when we found that out, I got on the horn with Chuck. First of all, we put a blast out to our partners throughout the state and throughout the country who pay attention to these things and are watching the development of these efforts. And we're standing up against the calling for a new ConCon. And so we got the word out immediately that, hey, folks, they're starting all over again in Ohio trying to get this thing going. And then I talked with Chuck and I said, Chuck, well, you know, here's the deal. I've already testified against this piece earlier in the spring when it had an earlier hearing, and so I won't be allowed to testify again. So I said, Chuck, can you please drop everything you're doing next week with your business and your family and your life, trundle down to Columbus on a Tuesday afternoon, and sit around and wait for however long it takes, maybe half an hour to an hour before you get to testify, on an issue that frankly should have died back in the spring. Thankfully, Chuck's a great, great friend, a wonderful vice chairman, and a great partner in constitutional education, and so he rose to the challenge. And Chuck, and I know just coming back from your trip to California for your trade show and the change in time and having to get reacclimated and all of that were challenges for you to try to get this done. And I just want to publicly say our grateful thanks to you for, you know, sacrificing your time to go and try to educate some Senate members on why this is a really bad idea.
Well, it wasn't something of a sacrifice, I suppose, but I don't want to emphasize that. It's one of those things that had to be done. I have missed a couple of these. Normally, I never miss one giving testimony. And it may have been, I don't know, providential that I didn't give it until the second time around for this thing. Just because I get to reignite the controversy. I mean, it was pretty clear that the chairman is pushing hard for it.
Yes, he's very much a proponent of the idea of calling for a convention.
Yes, and you pointed out, and I was sort of stunned, but I've run into this before, that the original sponsor of the bill, who's a member of the committee, wasn't there.
Yeah, he wasn't there that day. Now, he could have had any kind of legitimate excuse reasons for not showing up, but when you realize the real reason why a hearing was called on the bill, it really kind of makes it odd to find that the sponsor of the bill, who is a member of the committee, and that's Senator Matt Huffman from Lima, didn't show up for his own bill hearing. And I say that that's interesting, Chuck, because it wasn't just you testifying and at least 10 other people who submitted testimony. One came in and testified in person, and the other 9 submitted written testimony, all opposing the passage of this resolution to call for a convention. Okay, so you had 11 people testifying against it. You only had one person testifying in favor, but that's the reason why the hearing was called in the first place. Because that one person who is testifying as a proponent happens to be an employee of the Convention of States Project, And has, I guess I would say, some minor luminescence in the heavens of the conservative movement, Chuck. It was former United States Senator Jim DeMint. Now, DeMint had gone, and I think he headed up the Heritage Foundation for a little while after his stint in the U.S. Senate. And then he left, and now he's working with the Convention of States Project to try to push across the country for states to get in and adopt a call for a constitutional convention. And, of course, he was given the broadest amount of deference you could possibly give a human being without actually falling to your knees and worshiping them by the committee chair. You know, they were so pleased. They were so happy to have him there. They were so blessed by his presence. And he was there to straighten everybody out and to, you know, finally, once and for all, help us to understand why we need to support a call for a constitutional convention by the states. Chuck, how do you think he did in that mission?
Well, okay, let's put it this way. He did not give his submitted testimony at the hearing.
No, not fully. He kind of bounced around, and he hit a couple of snippets of it, but he didn't give... We have a copy of his written testimony, and of course, we'll have the link up on our webpage to the committee roster for all the testimonies of that day, including Chuck's, which was excellent, by the way, Chuck. Once again, you did a fantastic job. But, you know, DeMint, I mean, he had his written testimony is 4 pages long.
Yes.
So
it would have been longer than anybody else would have been allowed to testify.
right, because they actually were buzzering people when they reached the time limit. Now, again, Chuck, on this bill, now they had 5 or 6 other bills that they were hearing on that calendar in the afternoon, but all but one of them, nobody showed up to testify on. So they just, well, that constitutes this hearing of that bill, blah, blah, blah. We keep moving on.
Yeah, they just do a reading and
Yeah, it didn't take very long. And this was the 5th hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 1, which is Huffman's resolution to call for the convention. Now, it's the 5th hearing. Now, this thing started back in last winter, like in February, it was introduced. They had the sponsor testify in the 1st hearing. The Convention of States folks brought in some key luminaries during the 2nd hearing for all the proponents. They had a 3rd hearing, and it wasn't just opponent only. See, now there's the other thing you have to realize. If the proponents get a free day where they just get to testify and get asked questions and there's no counterpoint during the hearing, you would think that they would give the opponents the same deference. And in many committees, on many issues, they do. But not this one. That hearing was a proponent-opponent interested party testimony for the 3rd, and there were a lot of opponents who showed up. And then they had a 4th hearing, and there were a lot of opponents who showed up that day, including me. And unfortunately, we couldn't, because of scheduling, couldn't make the 3rd hearing, but we made the 4th hearing. And we testified, and I testified in opposition. And, of course, that's if you go when that link to the committee page, you can just go back to the dates and you can pull up my testimony as well as everybody else who testified in opposition to this resolution. And so we pretty much felt like at the end of spring when we testified that, frankly, I that's what I do for a living, Chuck. I'm a lobbyist, so I count noses. I could tell right away they don't have the votes on that committee. They haven't persuaded enough people to come across. Because you've got a couple of members on the committee who, number one, understand the issue and say no, Senator Chris Jordan being one, Senator Joe Eaker being another. You got a couple of members on that committee who are running for another office in the coming year, and they're worried about blowback if they happen to support this bill. That'd be Kevin Bacon from the Columbus area, who's going to be running for the House seat that he's giving up the Senate seat to get. And Senator Frank LaRose, who is a candidate for Secretary of State right now. So those guys are going to be a little hesitant as well. And then, of course, you have, you know, Chairman Bill Coley from Cincinnati and Matt Huffman, who are strong proponents of the bill. But they're pretty much alone, because even with this one, you know, and this measure, unlike others that we've seen in the past, the Democrats are not getting on board with this. They're very hesitant, and they don't like the idea anymore, although there was a time here about a year and a half ago, i.e. before Trump became president, that they were really kind of salivating over the idea of calling a constitutional convention. I think they believed that they'd get Hillary in office, the conservatives would call the convention, and then they could turn and change the Constitution any way they felt like, because of the force of authority of President Clinton and, of course, their network. But, of course, as we've seen, that whole thing fell apart on them. And so, therefore, there's no more active or enthusiastic support for a constitutional convention coming out of the Democrat Party. So there really aren't enough votes on that committee right now to be swayed to pass this bill. Or else they would have done it in the spring, Chuck. It would have been a foregone conclusion. Same with the House companion piece. It was savaged so badly by opponents in the committee that the committee chairwoman has not called it back up since April. It went the way of the lemming and the passenger pigeon back in April.
Yeah, the dodo.
I guess we still have some lemmings around, the dodo and the passenger pigeon. Yeah, that's right. But so here's the deal in the Senate. So they bring in what you called the big bat, you know, the guy who was going to bat cleanup and, you know, do a walk-off Grand Slam home run for the Convention of States folks. Wow. First pitch, whiff. Second pitch, foul ball. Third pitch, whiff. Fourth pitch, struck out looking.
Yeah.
And if you count, it actually only takes three strikes to be out. But because they love this guy so much, they gave him an extra one. So, Chuck, I mean, what I want to do here for folks is to help them to understand that what we're talking about isn't minor changes, or as DeMint's testimony talked about in his points, the things that we need to have happen. Imposing real fiscal restraints, and I put that in air quotes because I'm not sure what that actually is supposed to look like, real fiscal restraints on the federal government. The second thing that they're wanting is to limit federal power and jurisdiction. I thought that's what the Constitution did to start with, Chuck.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I guess maybe for some reason they don't think the document has those provisions in it. And number three, setting term limits for federal officials. Well, okay, Chuck, help me out here. Okay, we've tried term limits before for state and federal officials, right, in the early 90s.
Yeah, we did.
It applied to the states, and so that's the reason why we have term limits on state office holders, although you wouldn't think we do because they figured out a loophole where they could serve 8 years in one chamber and then flip and serve the 8 years in the other chamber, and as long as they can coordinate the timing, they can keep doing this ad infinitum, and we've got a couple of instances in the Ohio legislature where a Senate member and a House member just every 8 years just exchange seats.
Yes.
And they've done it now three times.
Yep.
You know, so did term limits actually work?
No.
Not the way that people intended them to work, let's put it this way. Yeah. And I think that was just because of oversights on how they drafted it. And whether or not term limits are a good idea, we're not arguing. But the point is that when we applied those term limits to our federal congressmen, the court said you don't have the authority to do that.
Yeah, they're federal officials, not state officials.
So you can't do that. Now, Chuck, that also exposes a major flaw in the fact that, people got cajoled into supporting the 17th Amendment to the Constitution to take away the power of a state legislature to direct and control the members of the United States Senate. When we went to direct election of senators with the 17th Amendment, the state legislatures lost their check and balance against the federal Congress because that's what the Senate was supposed to be. And it worked well historically, but then with the progressive era in the early 19-teens, we convinced and cajoled a bunch of people that it just wasn't working well anymore and we needed to have something that worked better, and so let's just elect our senators directly. Well, we see where that's gotten us now, as we have senators who basically run everywhere except in the state that they live in.
Exactly.
Because that's where the money is to raise. And then when they actually win the office, all the promises they made to the folks back home are eclipsed by all the promises they made to the big money donors out on the coasts. We see that. We know it happens. We've seen it happen ad infinitum, ad nauseum, especially here in Ohio. But I can't see, Chuck, where any of these three things that the Convention of States or COS project want are things that are going to be necessary to call a convention for and change our Constitution, because every one of these three things there's a provision in the existing Constitution that can be utilized to get you to your goals. But what it takes is the will, the fortitude, the resolution of the state governments to stand up to the federal government and not blink. And we see that happen in some states, especially out in the West. But we really are not seeing it much, and especially not in Ohio. And it's the thing you pointed out, this whole thing about imposing real fiscal restraints, the biggest cry from the chairman of the committee was that we're $20 trillion in debt in this country and blah, blah, blah. And if this isn't a crisis big enough to call, you know, to make the call for the convention, then what is? Chuck, what was your response to Senator Coley on that issue?
Well, I said, first of all, there were two facets to this, and I'll save the punch for the last part. But I essentially answered this. First of all the things that you've mentioned that have contributed to the $20 trillion, and as I testified, I said it's actually $20 trillion is a gross underestimation. You put in unfunded mandates that go out for another 60 or more years, 60 or 80 years. You're talking over $200 trillion, and that's not something we've made up. That we took those numbers from a couple of reports of people who have actually sat down and crunched the numbers. I said, these things are already forbidden. For instance, we have Congress requiring people to buy health insurance policies. We have Congress requiring, he gave a list when he asked me the question, and that's Chairman Coley. And I said, all those things are already forbidden by the Constitution. Essentially, the 10th Amendment requires that the laws be limited to the enumerated powers in Article 1 of the Constitution, and none of those things can be even stretched to make it look like they're included in the enumerated powers. And, you know, he talked a lot about the Commerce Clause and how it's been redefined. And I go, again, that is not a problem with the Constitution. That is a problem with Congress. And I was also, on a sideline, asked a question about the Supreme Court. You know, what if the Supreme Court blah, blah, blah? And I said, okay, I'm going to answer that by referring to Article 3 of the Constitution, which allows Congress to restrict the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court on some bills that do not fit a specific criteria. Congress may say simply that case cannot be heard by any federal court, including the Supreme Court. And I said, lest you think that is an obscure passage that never gets used. It was used in the mid-90s by Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle in a forestry bill. And what he basically did was, there was a bill that was important to his district, and he put a clause in there that said it was not reviewable by the Supreme Court or any federal court. So now, going back to your original question, I made the point that, you know, why are we calling a constitutional convention for powers that are already in the Constitution but aren't being enforced? And I said, why are we, do we continue to send the same people to Washington? Then I said, okay, I'm going to answer your question with a question. How much federal money has this body turned away?
And you could have heard a pin drop in the room, and the look on Coley's face was priceless.
Well, I need to thank my joke writer. Barry Sheets gave me the answer to that question. He goes, bring this up. He also reminded me to bring up the fact that this coming Sunday, yes, the day after you listen to the show, unless you're listening to a rerun, is the 240th anniversary of the passage of the Constitution.
230.
I'm sorry. Yeah, 230.
Yeah, 230.
Yeah, sorry. I really can do math, and I can't count change.
I gave him the right number in committee, so we didn't make the mistake.
Yeah, but Barry gave me that answer, and I'll be quite honest. I watched the two main members of the committee sort of reel back, put them on the back foot. They weren't quite sure how. Well, I got an instant answer, but it was lame. It was weak tea.
We've turned away plenty of federal money.
Yeah, we've turned away.
That was the answer. And it's like, when and where?
Senator Eaker can tell you we've turned away lots of federal money, and Barry and I talked about that afterwards. I said, Barry, you and I both know they turned away federal money because it was attached to a program that was so onerous that nobody would have accepted it. And I said, Barry said, yes, but if the feds attach more money to it, they take it.
Real ID is a great example.
Yes, real ID. In essence, the federal government didn't pay a big enough bribe. So if there's a big enough...
With real ID, the history was they first moved it as an implementation to the states without a funding stream. And, of course, many states rejected it just on that basis alone. But in many other states, Western states, and even in Ohio, we rejected it on grounds of, you know, the lack of freedom and
Fourth
the federalization
Amendment.
Of...
Yeah.
Yeah, Fourth Amendment grounds. So it got killed, but then later on during the Obama administration, the early part of the Obama administration, they hooked a funding stream to it. And sure enough, you saw state governors line up in droves to get this money, including Ohio, because the Ohio BMV, the Registrar of Vehicles, they're implementing real ID on the license plate.
Yep.
Because or on the your driver's license, it's not the plates. Because there was money attached to it. And, of course, our state government, as we know from our governor on down, are addicted to federal money.
Well, I want to bring that up. Let's talk about that just for a second. The fact is that the senators, all of them from both parties sitting on that committee, especially the Republicans who basically gave the governor this the present that he wanted, that he was going to win the presidency on, ha, 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 they gave him Medicaid expansion. Now, what are they? Now, what's the problem? There's no money. There's no money.
Well, yeah, the federal money is going to be started to be weaned off because that was the way it was originally intended. Not so much so that states could, you know, wean people off of it, but because they knew that that would hurt the states.
Yes. So what do we know is going on? The governor is out actively lobbying both the Ohio legislature and the federal legislature and the Department of Health and Human Services, hounding them for more money, more federal money. Well, does that not contribute to the debt and the deficit? And the answer is, of course it does. Those senators knew full well that I knew that their own party's, you know, the Republican Party governor was out lobbying for more federal money, not just a little bit, not like a single wallet full, wheelbarrows full of money, billions and billions of dollars that will be required to fund that program. And in the same breath, they're talking to me about a balance. But they asked me a question. I think Chairman Coley asked me a question about the balanced budget amendment. I go, Chairman Coley, I have read this amendment. It does nothing. It allows the federal government to spend up to 20% of the country's gross domestic product. 20%. Look, we have an almighty God in heaven who asks us for 10. And yet the government feels comfortable saying they can spend 20% of our money. Well, let's say you make $50,000 a year. That means the government comes in and takes $10,000 right off the top.
Well, that's about what they do anyway, isn't it?
Well, it's pretty close. It's not that. In fact, a lot of people are paying a third of their income in, they'll say, well, that's not my withholding tax. No, that's your Social Security tax and your Medicaid tax, Medicare tax. That's before the state government moves in. And I just basically said the balanced budget amendment simply allows you to ignore the restrictions in the amendment if the country is in a state of emergency. And I testified that, as we all know, we've been in an uninterrupted state of emergency since December of 1941. Which means this balanced budget amendment will do nothing. There are provisions in that thing that are big enough to drive three semis through three semis abreast through on the budget. It will do nothing. So we're going to throw a constant, an all-in constitutional convention for an amendment, which will do nothing. You know, we all know that John Kasich, and what I wanted to testify to, and I just really didn't have time, didn't get asked the right questions. I think Chairman Coley kind of got gun-shy after that last question. That wasn't the last question. I got the question about the Supreme Court, which I also think I sort of hit at least a triple on. And with the, you know, why isn't Congress stripping them of jurisdiction? And the answer is nobody really wants to do anything. The fact is we want to have this feel-good convention. And I will tell you folks out there what I really wanted to tell these people, and that is, let's understand something. I did say everybody's under the impression that this is going to be a big conservative love fest. I said it's not. California is not going to send a conservative faction to a constitutional convention. Washington and Oregon won't. Colorado won't. New Mexico won't. Illinois won't. New York won't. Connecticut won't. Massachusetts won't. Maine, I said, you can go through the list. Other delegations will be a mixed bag. And basically what Chairman Coley said was that, well, I know I have over 50% of the legislatures that will agree with me, and the ratification procedure protects us. And I'm like, but I've just testified to the fact that the ratification procedure can be changed by a convention who has plenipotentiary power. That point continues to be poo-pooed, and I think it's very important. You know, the Convention of States project, and before them the Goldwater Institute, and what's the ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, before them. Basically, when we brought these points up, they just said, well, we're going to ignore that because that's never going to happen. And I go, you know what? That's what that's what people thought in 1787. In fact, I wrote a booklet on to that point, that Rhode Island didn't come because they said, well, if we don't go, then they can't do anything because it requires 13 states.
Right.
And guess what? They got surprised, and they were the last ones to come into the Union. 18 months after George Washington was already inaugurated president, they came in.
Yep.
So, I really think.
Well, you know, the other thing, I'm glad you brought up the whole issue earlier, because as DeMint was testifying, it was interesting. Coley took all of the opponents first, so that DeMint could come in and back clean up and correct all the errors that you guys had laid down. Supposedly, of course, you didn't lay down error, but. He starts in with his testimony, and of course he was kind of sort of staying with his testimony like in the first paragraph, and I have a copy of it here, and he said this whole thing here, blah blah blah. He says the very survival of our nation is now in the hands of the collective states, not Washington politicians. And I couldn't help but think, Chuck, if anybody's ever seen the old Disney movie Johnny Tremaine, okay, about the whole thing with the Boston Tea Party, etc., There's a place where they're having the meeting, the big meeting, and the code word Sam Adams was going to use to tell people that the Tea Party was on. I came across my mind when DeMint said these words, and my thought was, this meeting can do nothing more to save the country. because that's really what calling for an Article 5 constitutional convention of state, whatever term you want to use, amendments convention, whatever.
Yeah,
you want to use for it.
Remember, Uncle Sam's.
It ultimately gets down to that futility.
I called it Uncle Sam's limited government barbecue and constitutional hoedown. And I said,
exactly, which drew some laughs from the audience, which I thought was good. But so as I look through, and I'm not going to read out all of DeMint's testimony here, folks. I mean, you can, like I said, you can go online, you can find it if you really are interested. But I did highlight a couple, three things that he did say in his testimony, and he actually did say when he was standing up there, you know, kind of somewhat ad-libbing because he couldn't get away. He's probably given the same testimony, Chuck, dozens of times.
Dozens
of times. So he's probably got it almost memorized word for word. But he basically, he says, well, we've got to address these those three topics that we talked about earlier at a convention where delegations from all 50 states sit down. And I stopped and said, what about Rhode Island? Because you and I both know there are going to be states that even if these jokers get to their magic number and they get a convention called, there are going to be some states that are going to be like, I don't want any part of that.
Yes.
Now, of course, you know, at this point, unlike the original 1787, where Rhode Island thought that actually making that play would block it entirely because they believed that the Articles of Confederation were the government operational document, and it took unanimous consent from all 13 colonies to make any changes to the document. So if they didn't show up, nothing could be done. Well, boy, they got fooled.
Yeah, boy, did they.
You know, you may get a number of states who look at this and say, I'm not going to waste my time, energy, or effort on this because you guys are never going to get this done. And then, of course, he says, you know, we do all these things and do all these specific proposals. Now, of course, these three proposals are going to be in play, according to Jim DeMint. And he's like, then these proposals, of course, then go back to the states for ratification. Now, Chuck, you and I know that the two little words, of course, means I haven't thought enough on this.
Yes.
When it comes out of the mouth of a COS.
Yeah.
The two words, of course, means I'm an idiot. Now, I'm just going to lay that right out there, and I don't care who gets upset about it. Jim DeMint's showing he's an idiot because he won't listen and understand history. The original governing document of this country that we were formed under after the War for Independence were the Articles of Confederation. Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, it took the unanimous consent of all 13 colonies to make any changes. Why then do we have a Constitution of the United States that now is only ratified by 3/4 of the states, and in that era that was 9 out of the 13, when Rhode Island didn't even send anybody to the convention to make the changes? Under our current form of government, under the current form of government of the time, it shouldn't have ever been able to happen. But, as you and I both know from history, Chuck, because we actually study it, when the convention was convened, even after all the delegates had had all these charges from their state governments and their governors, limiting them to what they could talk about, which was one real topic, which was trade amongst the states under the Articles of Confederation.
Right. Interstate commerce
clause. That was
it. Yeah,
interstate commerce. That was it. That was the only topic.
Yep.
They get into Philadelphia. The first thing they did was they didn't want anybody to know what was going on. So in the middle of a Philadelphia summer from May until September in Independence Hall, and if you've ever been there, you can walk around and look. They took the wooden shutters on the windows and closed them and nailed them closed. Nobody could open a window. It's hot in Philadelphia.
Yes, it is.
In the middle of summer, and there was no such thing as air conditioning back then. And so, and if you remember the clothing of the time, a lot of it was woolen. How would you like to be wearing multiple layers of wool clothing in the second story of the old Independence Hall with all the windows closed and the shutters nailed shut? They did this so nobody could find out what they were doing. Because the next thing they did was they voted to secede from the old Union, to throw off the Articles of Confederation, and bring in an entirely different form of government. Now, folks, if you don't think that can happen today because Jim DeMint and folks from COS are promising you that the states are going to be in control, again, you're just saying, of course. And that's not really a smart place to be. So Jim DeMint thinks that the same ratification procedure we have now will be the ratification procedure that will come out of a new convention. Why would you even remotely think they'd want to do that? I mean, if you got something that, let's say, if you knew you're bringing an issue, let's say abortion on demand, full access for anybody at any age to slaughter an unborn child, you know there are going to be probably a number of states, and it's probably more than 13,
who won't stand for that.
But, okay, Chuck, if you've got 32 states, and those states include California, Illinois, New York, Massachusetts. I can go down the list here.
You can go down the list. Yeah, it's very easy to do.
Liberal states. And you look at, and just look back at the presidential election. how many physical bodies do you have in those states versus states who would say, no, we won't support that? Why would you go to states ratifying? Heck no, you're going to go to a plebiscite. You're going to say national popular vote.
Exactly.
That we'll just have the people vote on it, and when we get enough people, we win. And, of course, most of those liberal states would win all the time.
All you got to do is 50% plus one.
The New Yorks, the Californias, the Illinois of the world.
50% plus one of the voting population. And, of course, it will be rife with fraud. They could even go to an online voting scenario, that kind of thing. Barry, this was tacitly the point I was making. There are any number of things that will be up for grabs under a constitution. Okay, you want your balanced budget amendment, which, by the way, the Democrats are fully aware this thing does nothing. They're not squawking too hard about it. I mean, they squawk because you've got to, because it has balanced budget attached to it, but they know it doesn't do anything. So here's what would happen in a constitutional convention. The progressive states, let's say California, let's say the West Coast contingent, would come out and say, okay, you can have your balance of budget, but we want the Second Amendment. We want major concessions made on the Second Amendment, and you can have your balanced budget.
It wouldn't even be quite that far yet, because what they'd say is, we'll let you balance the budget, but we need to take away these rights of religious belief.
Exactly. First Amendment.
The First Amendment stuff.
The entire Bill of Rights is up for grabs if the first. Now, am I saying it would be wiped out? No, it would be altered to the point that it would be meaningless.
Exactly. Now, but Chuck. Jim DeMint would say that you are delusional because, hey, he knows full well that all that convention can do is just recommend amendments, and it has to be ratified by these 38 states. And he said in his art, if we don't have 13 states that will stop a crazy amendment to the Constitution, we're in a lot more trouble than any of us can fix. Well, Jim, wake up, open your eyes.
Yeah,
we're in a lot more trouble than any of us can fix. And what you have is what I call, Chuck, and I've tagged this phrase, true believer derangement syndrome, TBDS. COS proponents are suffering from this. It's a massive delusional system that says that everything is going to be just like it always was, and nobody's going to be making any major changes, and everything will just be hunky-dory, and we'll just get all the little nirvana things that we want out of this, and nobody else will get hurt.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Chuck, that they're like teenagers who are playing with guns. Playing with a gun. And when the gun happens to go off because the teenager wasn't smart enough to realize how to handle a gun or hadn't studied it, and then they're looking, you know, it's too late to say, oh, can I take that back once it's done? Once the trigger's been pulled on a constitutional convention, it'll be too late to say, oops, can we have a do-over? As the body politic will be laying on the floor.
Or our friend Mike Perutka, if you go out on YouTube, you can find a thing... that he did a YouTube video under the American View that's something like, what can I undo for you?
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting because if you keep going in DeMint's testimony here, just a couple more points we need to bring up out of this. He says, kind of wrapping it up, he says, I believe the American people will not rest until we get to 34 states. Now, they think they've got 12 states that have passed this COS amendment. We will not rest until we get to 34, have our convention, ha-ha, and usher in a constitutional renaissance. Okay? This is his pipe dream. This is TBDS fully blown. Now, Chuck, I want to just share with you my thought when I saw the words constitutional renaissance. And I thought, wow, renaissance, that's an interesting term to use, because the renaissance was a secular movement throwing off the bounds of biblical morality and authority on the culture. Gee, just like it will do to our current constitution, throwing off the chains that bind tyrannical governments and protects our freedom. He couldn't have used a better word.
No.
He's right. It will be a renaissance. But for those who look past the brushstrokes and the sculptures that came out of the renaissance, you will see that what also came out of the Renaissance was Enlightenment, secular, paganistic philosophies that are to this day a cancer on any nation that has adopted them. Now, Senator DeMint, I'm not saying anything about his faith and belief, but I'd have to say that he is suffering from TBDS. And it's so bad, Chuck, it can make you believe things. You will say things that actually contradict your stated positions. And this is the other thing I wanted to bring up. And you and I talked about this after his testimony.
Right.
Was that as he was sitting there telling all the protections around the convention, you know, to reassure the legislators how wonderful it's going to be for a convention, he basically stated how important it was that 34 states all passed the exact same language for their calls for a convention. Okay? Now, Chuck, you and I both know that the reason why he said that was because in Article 5 of the Constitution, there's language in there that says that when the states call upon Congress for a convention, all of the calls must be identical. It says that, doesn't it?
No, it does not.
That's right. Wait a minute. No, it doesn't say that. Oh, but what has happened is that Congress, who we rightly assert control everything beyond the states sending an appeal to Congress to get a convention, Congress controls all aspects of the convention until the gavel drops on the convention. That means Congress has already asserted their hegemony and control over the fact that Jim DeMint and COS believe that they have to have every one of the 34 states' calls be identical in language. That's not a constitutional requirement. That's a congressional fiat requirement.
It's about,
so even in talking about his the reason why they think they can protect against Congress controlling it and the convention being controlled by the delegates who Congress will pick, they believe the states get to pick them, but it's not going to happen. He's basically laying down the assumption implicitly that Congress already controls the process from the get-go.
Yes.
So at what point do you think Congress is going to realize, oh, well, you know, I guess that the emanating from the penumbras of the shadows of that Article 5 is the states get all the power. I mean, who is going to be the state's Potter Stewart in interpreting Article 5, saying that there's emanations from the penumbras of the shadows?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we are pretty close to out of time, but I will say this. I have pointed out on many, many, many different occasions that a plenipotentiary convention can change the entire ratification procedure. They are empowered to do that by the simple fact that they've been appointed to that position. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that the states will pick delegates because it has to be remembered that during the first convention, the only body that could possibly have appointed delegates were the states because Congress had no authority whatsoever. They were simply delegates from a state that met together to pound out agreements between the states. Article 5 of the Constitution federalized the process, and I'm not sure that George Mason meant to do that.
No, I don't believe he did.
But he did. And if you look at the language, you can look on our website. I had a question from someone, the Founding Fathers gave us this wonderful gift. And I said, do you not realize that when the Founders created this quote-unquote gift, none of them agreed to what the gift actually said? The meanings of the words. That's the problem. And now we have a situation where the federal government is considered to be the ultimate authority on virtually everything. And that means that they're going to decide to allow any changes in the ratification procedure to go through. Well, these guys have the power to do that. We have to let them do it. So they've decided on a 50% plus one online plebiscite. So get out there and vote early and vote often, I guess, would be the obvious. That being said, we are out of time. You know what we think about this. we do really want to know what you think about this. Please go online, www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And let us know. And by the way, our condolences to Tom DeWeese, who of the American Policy Center, whose wife has passed away this last week due to the complications from a stroke. Not an old woman by any stretch. She's in her 50s. So our condolences to Tom. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.